President Trump has appointed Dr. Robert Redfield as the new director for the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, or the CDC. Redfield's appointment comes at a tumultuous time for the Atlanta-based centers. Trump's first pick, Dr. Brenda Fitzgerald, left a directorship last month after it was reported that she had financial stakes in the tobacco industry. And Redfield's not without some controversy himself. There are allegations he fabricated study data for the Army in the 1990s, and he's advocated for separating HIV-positive soldiers from their comrades. And he's never had experience leading a public health organization. So what does it take to be a successful CDC director? We took that question to a person who knows, a former CDC director himself. GPB special correspondent Celeste Headley spoke with Dr. Tom Frieden early last year as he prepared to lead the CDC.
How do you decide what is winnable? What are the sort of components that go into that?
I think of it kind of in a very logical way. You first ask the question, what's killing people or causing disability? Then you ask the question, of those causes, which of them are actually preventable? There's some that we can do a much better job preventing. There are others that we don't yet have the tools to prevent. And then when you have that list of those that are preventable, how do you go about doing it?
So, like an example of one we don't quite have the tools to prevent, car accidents, is that sort of in
there? Oh, actually, we know very well how to reduce motor vehicle fatalities. In fact, that was one of our winnable battles, and we came close to achieving our goal. What we did with winnable battles was to come up with a proactive agenda. Often in government, you're tempted to just deal with the inbox, see what happens, and respond day by day. And we had a pretty busy inbox between Ebola, MERS, Zika, pandemic influenza. But we had a really proactive approach, and that's why, because of the work of CDC, America is safer and healthier today than it was before. Take your example of motor vehicle crashes. There are things that can be done, for example, to reduce the risk that kids will get into crashes with graduated driver licenses. When I grew up, we didn't have those. You had a learner's permit for a while, then you started driving. Now, graduated driver licenses are very effective at reducing the risk. The risks when people start driving are massively higher than risks later in life. Second thing that can be done is reduce the risk of drunk driving. There's been a real understanding that drunk driving is something that is a peril to the public. You don't want your kid to get killed by someone who's intoxicated when he's or she's walking to school in the morning. And there are things that can be done to reduce drunk driving as a cause of motor vehicle crashes. And, of course, both the road construction approach and the vehicle safety approaches have made major impacts reducing motor vehicle fatalities.
So one of the criticisms of the winnable battles when the CDC released that was that it didn't include gun deaths. I want to read a question that the CNN posed, and they said, quote, why is the nation's leading public health official a nonstop messaging machine not talking about something that kills more than 30,000 people a year in the U.S.? That's more than the number of Americans who die of AIDS or colon cancer or prostate cancer, more than the number of people who died in the entire international Ebola outbreak. What's the answer to that?
Well, first, CDC does what Congress directs us to do. Congress is essentially the board of directors for CDC. Our budget is very specific and very structured. It's broken down into about 200 different lines, and we do not have freedom to decide what we do. We have freedom to decide how we're going to do it, but Congress determines what we work on. Realistically, we've asked in each of the past years for resources to study gun violence and figure out ways to reduce it as a health issue, and Congress said, no, we don't fund you to do that. However, what we have done is to work with states to expand something called the National Violent Death Reporting System. That gives states the resources and technical input so that they can track every suicide and homicide in the state and understand what the causes were so they can try to prevent it. States have done that, and they've taken actions. For example, Oklahoma, when it looked at its data, saw that many of the homicides were among women who had previously had a domestic violence issue, and therefore they strengthened their approach to domestic violence. In Oregon, they found that there were many suicides among the elderly, so they strengthened suicide prevention measures among the elderly. There is no question that the U.S. is an outlier when it comes to gun deaths, both suicide and homicide. And I would hope that we could develop more information, but also implement the things that we know work to reduce the risk that there will be accidental or suicide or homicide from guns.
So you were just talking about states and also the relationship with Washington, and you'd mentioned to me that the CDC is the largest government agency that's not based in the larger D.C. area. What difference does that make? How does it either help or hurt the CDC to be separate, literally, from Washington?
CDC is the largest federal agency headquartered outside of the Washington, D.C. area. We're here in Georgia. That is our home. We have more than 10,000 staff and contractors working here, a payroll of over $1 billion. That leads to about $2 billion in industrial output here in Georgia. We bring in about 150,000 visitors a year to Georgia. We also spend about $1 million a day on purchases for things that we need to keep
CDC. $1 million a day?
To keep CDC running. And we partner for nearly $200 million a year with Georgia universities. So we have a big economic footprint in Georgia. But being in Georgia means two things. First, we are, I hope, a little insulated from some of the issues that
political
swirl
wrangling
around in Washington. However, we're also a little far from where budgets are decided. And that's why it's particularly important that people in Georgia, particularly the elected representatives here, make clear that investing in CDC is a best buy.
That sounds like you're talking straight to David Perdue and Johnny Isaacson.
Well, Senator Isaacson has been wonderful. He's come to CDC many times. He's traveled and seen what we do around the world. He really gets the fact that CDC is good for America. It saves lives, saves money. It's a best buy. Senator Perdue is newer. He's been to CDC, and we look forward to working with him. But also in the House, we need people really making clear that CDC is an investment. We protect America, and if we cut that, we make America less safe.
So you began sort of your high-profile career working with tuberculosis, and your fight against an epidemic of tuberculosis in NYC. People have studied that as a model of how to treat an epidemic, and this really interests me because there is so much personal human chaos involved in fighting disease. How do you efficiently organize a department to fight an epidemic? I mean, I guess that's what people study when they look at that as a model, right?
What I've always tried to do is come up with what I call a technical package, a limited number of interventions which, if done well, will result in a specific outcome. In New York City, we made sure to diagnose patients promptly, treat them completely, reduce the risk that they would spread the disease in hospitals, and track the outcomes of every patient. Underlying all of that was one single concept, accountability. We were accountable to the patients for making sure that they got cured. And were you able to do that in TB? Because you can get close to a 100% cure rate. But we found that patients were dropping out, maybe because they were poorly treated, maybe because they had mental health problems, maybe because they had drug-resistant bacteria that weren't effectively treated. We put in a system to track every single patient in the city and ensure that they completed treatment. Some people objected to the fact that when people wouldn't take medicine, if nothing else would work, we would put them in a hospital till they were cured. But, you know, as we learn in high school, your right to swing your fist ends at my nose. And so we made sure that we were treating the patient as the VIP of the program. We reached out to homes, even sent people into crack dens to give people medication. But in the end, we very rapidly controlled it and did that through a combination of technical rigor in diagnosis and treatment and human contact, reaching out to patients and making sure that they got the care and treatment that they needed.
Now, you've mentioned one thing that sort of complicates your job in fighting disease, and that's privacy rights. Many people didn't want to be stuck in a hospital bed. But there are other things that complicate it. Then you get culture and society and even religion. And one of the winnable battles, for example, for the CDC was teen pregnancy. And there's all kinds of things that get involved in the battle with teen pregnancy. How does a scientist deal with all that, again, that chaos and mess that is inherently human?
We find that there's really an interplay between laws and regulations and programs and the cultural norms. Think of the things that have changed in the past few decades in this country, from would you like a cigarette, to be polite, to do you mind if I smoke, to not even asking, do you mind if I smoke if you're in most people's houses. That's a cultural change that facilitated and was facilitated by things like smoke-free laws. Or think about drunk driving. It used to be common to say, would you like another drink for the road? Now it's friends don't let friends drink and drive. So that kind of cultural change is important. Teen pregnancy is at the lowest levels ever documented. And that's a combination of things. It is some delay in sexual onset of teenagers and a big increase in access to contraception.
We have about a minute left, and I wonder, what work do you leave behind? What did you not get to finish at the CDC?
Well, I think CDC can be encouraged by the progress we made in the past 8 years. America is safer and healthier because of the work we did. We have better prepared laboratories, more staff at more places, better tracking systems so we know where things are happening. We stopped threats in this country. We worked around the world so we have a tripwire and we'll understand when threats are arising elsewhere better than before. But there's still much more to be done. We still need to do better helping other countries detect problems there so we can stop them there and don't have to fight them here. We still don't have a rapid response fund so that the next time there's an emergency, we won't have to wait 9 months for Congress to act, but can nip a problem at the bud.
That's referring specifically like Ebola and Zika, where the CDC had that problem.
Zika in particular, but even with Ebola, when Congress acted quickly, we didn't have what are called emergency authorities. So we had to follow the usual government systems, which can take months when we need to take action hours.
That was Tom Frieden, former director of the CDC, speaking with GPB special correspondent Celeste Headley. It's On Second Thought. I'm Tony Harris. Governor Nathan Deal announced early this week that he plans to add $100 million to the state budget for public transit expansion to be spent over the next 10 years. There are no details yet on what, but anytime Georgians talk about public transit, there's a usual list of possibilities. Express lanes on highways, rail transit like MARTA, and better bus service in the suburbs. Some neighborhoods and counties in Metro Atlanta have resisted transit expansion in the past, including Gwinnett and Clayton counties. People have expressed concerns about MARTA service bringing crime with it. But as it turns out, those concerns might not have much traction. GPB special correspondent Celeste Headley talked about this way back in 2014 with Eric Jaffe and Darren Givens, blogger at the ATL Urbanist.
Eric, first, talk to me about the myth of mass transit bringing crime. I mean, that's a long-standing idea that when you give people access to wealthier communities, they're going to use it to take things.
Yeah, I mean, Atlanta is certainly not unique in this. You see it across the country as a regular objection to expanding transit systems and transit service. And as you said, I mean, sure, in theory it makes sense. You build a new transit route, you give access to a new neighborhood. You could theoretically give criminals access to new victims. But when you look at the evidence across the board, I mean, it's pretty clearly in people's minds. I mean, it doesn't actually exist. It's a myth. It's unsubstantiated by the research, and can be even worse in terms of being veiled prejudice.
So, Darren, you ride public transportation here, right?
Yeah, I'm a MARTA commuter.
And so how often are you left in a station where there's nobody around and you feel unsafe?
You know, that never happens during the major commute times. I mean, I'm in the station waiting with people at the regular 9-to-5 kind of commute times. And I'm on full trains, sometimes terribly full trains. And so I'm not really in that situation, though I know that it's understandable that people in the station alone at night when there's no security guards around, few eyes on them, might feel, upset.
Well, in 2012, the state actually voted against a reasonable transportation measure that called T-SPLOST. Here is Debbie Dooley. She's Georgia's Tea Party, speaking after that vote.
This is a victory for we the people and for the people. This is the people's victory. We have been fighting this battle for a year and a half, and I cannot tell you how good this feels. Yes!
Eric, help me understand this mindset, a victory for the people of turning down public transportation. You're saying that comes because it's seen as a protection from crime?
Well, I mean, there are many reasons that people oppose transit, public transportation, and I'm not sure why that particular lady does oppose it.
Yeah, if it's a Tea Party, it could be just government expenditure.
Yeah, crime could be one reason. But it is a common objection that you hear across the country.
And I wanted to place here, here's an Atlanta resident quoted in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution in 1977. This is a quote that you included in your piece. Quote, having MARTA increases the chances of crime. Criminals can get off the train and break into your home and get back onto the train. I don't think that's as likely to happen on buses where they have to walk past the driver to get on board. Eric, how is that supported or not supported by data?
Yeah, I mean, that's the common complaint. People just, they get it in their minds that a criminal is going to take this new bus service into their area. And it's not necessarily the situation that Darren was describing. In terms of being left at a station, although that is a security concern. But I think for a lot of the outspoken concern, it's that, you know, new population is going to come into an old environment and commit crimes. But when, you know, researchers actually evaluate this, as they've done around MARTA stations that exist, they don't find that these connections exist. I mean, they might see a little bit of a bump in certain crimes directly after the new station opens, but these tend to decline over time, and they tend to revert to the previous levels of the previous crime rates that were already established in the area. So there's no evidence that the transit itself is making the situation worse.
Darren, I mean, we don't have specific data. We don't know people's motivations in when they decide not to support public transportation projects. But what's your anecdotal sense? I mean, do you hear from people complaints about this?
You know, the thing is, as far as these anecdotes of one person or two people speaking out at a meeting and giving these quotables about fears of MARTA being crime, leading crime into a neighborhood, I think that it's dangerous to put too much emphasis on that. I mean, you've got this proof of acceptance of transit expansion in Atlanta by way of Clayton County's vote. They want transit. They want MARTA in their county. There was a fairly recent poll that showed people in Metro Atlanta in general are interested in spending government money on transit expansion, more so than on road expansion to relieve congestion.
And yet what we're doing right now is building more roads.
To an extent. I mean, yes, I don't know that we're really building more roads.
I'm talking about the toll roads that are going kind of up north.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Sure. Yeah. Toll roads is a way of relieving congestion. But, you know, Cobb County is trying to build a bus rapid transit line from Kennesaw State University down into Midtown Atlanta. I mean.
Well, help me understand then, as a new resident of Metro Atlanta. Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the first questions people ask is, why doesn't Atlanta, where congestion is so bad, where the commute time is much higher than the average across the nation, what has held back public transportation so far?
You know, there was very much an overall metro-wide anti-transit stance long ago when this vote was made to expand MARTA into the general metro, into the sort of five-county urban core in the late 60s, early 70s. It was rejected by everyone but Fulton and DeKalb County. And that was a different world. I mean, we're living in a world now where there have been incredible demographic shifts in the metro. We've got much more racial diversity out in the suburbs. We've got economic diversity. We've got poverty growing in the suburbs. We've got all kinds of changes where it makes more sense for transit to be expanded. And I sense that there is a general consensus that it is a good thing to expand transit throughout the metro now.
And yet, Eric, you found that these fears of increased crime persist over decade after decade after decade, despite what the data says. Isn't that right?
Yeah, it's true. But Darren makes a great point. I mean, Clayton County's vote was really historic. It's a huge step for MARTA. It's a huge step for mobility in Atlanta. And so when you have transit opponents say defeating transit is the people's victory, I mean, that's actually the opposite of what's true. It is a people's victory to expand and improve public transportation. And what we see with, you know, comments like that suggest that crime and transit are connected, that's just one more way to keep a lingering objection to transit. And what we're trying to do here is to show those people, if they truly do have that fear, that they don't need to. They can ease their mind about that.
So, Darren, moving forward, I mean, that comment from Debbie Dooley, and Debbie Dooley, if you're listening, call us and let us know how you feel about public transit. But that comment was only a couple years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So clearly there's still a strong resistance to public transit in Atlanta and Metro Atlanta. But do you think that the balance is shifting?
I think it's shifting, and I don't think that we should read into that TSPLOST vote too much about public transit in particular.
Why?
Because that TSPLOST vote was about a huge package of things involving highways and public transit together, and I think that there was something about the structure of that put people off.
You mean like the size of it or the cost of it?
The size of it, the cost of it, the fact that it was being done in general across a huge metro-wide area. I think that might have had more to do with accepting this huge package for the entire metro area all at once rather than public transit expansion in particular.
So before we go, Eric, I just want to reemphasize one more time. Your message through your research and your writing is, if you're one of the people who's still worried that mass transit brings increased crime, don't. Right?
Exactly. I mean, there's just no evidence for you to have that fear. I mean, you could have it, but once you start to rationalize it, it doesn't hold up. And when we talked with the MARTA's police chief, she gave us a comment saying that they're very aware of these studies, and they know that the quote was, the premise that transit exacerbates unlawful activity is false.
Now, let's dream big for a second. What if Governor Deal's budget boost brought something totally new? High-speed rail ideas have been kicked around in Georgia for years now, but it's never really actually happened.
Plan for a high-speed train moving from Columbus to Atlanta at speeds of over 200 miles an hour.
220 miles an hour, that'd take you more than the length of a football field in just a second, and obviously from downtown Charlotte to Atlanta pretty fast.
Plans for a new high-speed rail train could get you to the Georgia coast faster than you can drive from one end of the metro area to the other.
So what would a network of super-fast trains do for Georgia and the whole of the Southeast? And what would it take to get them? Here's Celeste Headley again, speaking with Carrie Watkins, assistant professor at Georgia Tech School of Civil and Environmental Engineering, and Dan Richard, chairman of the board for the California High-Speed Rail Authority.
How do you know whether or not a rail system would be profitable or worth it?
So we would sit down and do a study looking at what the cost of it would be versus how many riders we would actually expect in that corridor. And there's a lot of things that we have to take into account. Every time you build a station in between the two endpoints, that means more people are going to use the corridor. But it also means it's not going to be high-speed rail because you're losing a lot of time in having the train accelerate, decelerate every time it goes in and out of a station. So you really need strong anchors on either end. And you also need that draw. You need to have good publicity so that people are actually going to use the corridor. And you need good transportation at each of the endpoints so that once you get there, you actually have a way to get around. That's why a lot of the corridors that we've seen that have been the most successful, like out of the Chicago area in the Northeast Corridor, Seattle to Portland, these are places that have a very good urban transportation system, so good transit systems in those urban areas. But then they're also connected well by inner city passenger rail.
So when we talk about high speed rail, how fast is that? Is Kasim Reed right when he said you would ideally leave Atlanta and be in Savannah an hour and a half later?
So the best systems in the world, in Japan, in France,
the bullet trains
are running about 200 miles an hour for an average for their whole route. So, I mean, they're getting to 180, 190 miles an hour the whole route. In the Northeast Corridor, we've got a couple of short segments where they're running at 150 miles an hour. Most of the corridor is more like 110 to 120.
When you say Northeast Corridor, you're talking about like train a lot of people take between D.C. and New York.
Yeah, the Acela trains.
Right, which is a lovely train. Can I ask you, Dan, first, why it has taken this long? I'm a native of California, and they have been talking about high-speed rail since I was born in 1970. So why does a project like this take so long to come to fruition?
Well, unfortunately, these days, any infrastructure project takes a long time to come to fruition. And, you know, California is a state that cares very much about its environment. And so whenever we're going to build something major like this, we have to be very careful how we do it and go step by step. But we're in construction now, which is an exciting change. We've actually started building the first leg of what's going to be 520 miles connecting San Francisco and Los Angeles.
What takes longer? Is it the political argument?
Well, you know, we live in a pluralistic society, and people have different views about things, and so obviously that does take a long time. The environmental clearance is very important. We can't just bulldoze people out of the way. That happens in some parts of the world, but that's not the way it's going to happen in the United States. So we have to be careful in picking our routes. In California, I'm sure you'd face this in Georgia. We deal with urban areas, we deal with farms, we deal with all kinds of different communities, and we have to pick alignments very carefully, and yet we're sure that we can do that in a way that won't avoid all impacts but can minimize them, and this is a system that's going to serve our people for generations to come.
I want to play a complaint from one of Dan's constituents. This is Sean Carafin, and he is with the San Diego County Taxpayers Association. Here he is.
For the same price, we could purchase 2 million Chevy Sparks, just give them away in exchange for the gas guzzlers, and we would have an immediate environmental impact. For the same price, it just looks like a worse and worse project, yet we're still breaking ground. It's really embarrassing for California.
Carrie, I'm not expecting you to defend California, but this is a common argument when it comes to large infrastructures. And obviously here in Atlanta, we've had a lot of arguments over whether or not mass transit is worth the price. How do you make these calculations?
So that kind of argument is a near-term versus long-term discussion of investment. So what he's talking about is we could buy these today and we would be able to get people there for the next 5 years, maybe. But the infrastructure investments that we're talking about in something like high-speed rail, this is a 50, 100, longer than that even time frame investment that we're talking about making where people would be well served.
So Dan, you know, infrastructure projects like these, and I think James Fallows wrote about this pretty eloquently in The Atlantic, they've never really been popular. He points out, going back as far as the Louisiana Purchase, it's always brings a lot of criticism with it, a lot of fighting. And yet you've been involved not just in this, but in BART as well, which is up in San Francisco. How do you prepare yourself, I guess, more importantly, why keep doing this to yourself? Because you're never going to make everybody happy.
Well, I think Professor Watkins really nailed it. I mean, this is about the long term. This is about investing in the future. In California, we're facing the prospect of having 50 million people here by 2050. That's the equivalent of the state of Ohio lifting up and moving to California.
That was GPB special correspondent Celeste Headley speaking with Kerry Watkins and Dan Richard. I'm Tony Harris. This is On Second Thought. Today is sine die, the last day of the state legislative session. And tomorrow we will talk with GPB Capitol correspondent Lisa Raham about what will be heading to Governor Nathan Deal's desk and what might actually become law. What bills and issues do you want us to break down? Give us a call. We're at 404-500-9457. You can also post to Facebook or Twitter. We're at OST Talk. The massacre at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, and the March for Our Lives movement have brought gun violence to the forefront once again in this country. But it can be a challenge to remember, amidst all the politics, that there are real implications for people who experience gun violence firsthand. Some are, of course, victims and survivors. But there are also the doctors who treat gunshot wounds every day. Let's revisit a conversation I had in October last year with Dr. Omar Danner of Grady Memorial Hospital in Atlanta, and George Lee. He's with the Savannah-based End Gun Violence Step Forward Initiative. What did the data ultimately show you? What did you learn?
You start looking at the demographics of people who are injured. Those people who are 0 to 44 years of age, gun violence actually is the fifth leading cause of death nationally. But when you look at it locally, particularly in the high-risk population, we call that 15 to 34 age group, it's the most common cause of death for African-American males and the second leading cause of death among Hispanic males.
And you looked at it statewide, and then you brought it down to Atlanta.
Yeah, we looking at it from a statewide perspective. Yeah. When you look at gun violence, most people think that when you get shot with a gun, it's mostly just homicides. Mm-hmm. Actually, suicides account for 60% of the injuries or deaths in Georgia, and 38% are homicides due to gun violence. But when you look at us compared to national levels, there's a 43% greater incidence or risk of homicide-related gun violence in Georgia compared to the rest of the United States.
Did that surprise you? I'm wondering what assumptions you had going in. What did you think you'd find when the data came in, and what did you actually find?
What I thought we would find, we thought we would mirror the nation, but when we start looking at this as a hospital system, what we found was that, one, there's an overrepresentation of particularly African Americans and particularly African American males. In fact, 91% of the victims were male, and there was about 80% African American, 60% Hispanic in the Atlanta area.
Did that really surprise you?
It is, in that, you know, when we think about health disparities, there is 8 to 9 times higher chance of being injured or killed by a gun if you're African-American male. When we look at diabetes, we look at cancer, we look at all the other health maladies, this represents maybe the greatest health disparity of all.
Mm-hmm. When you're having conversations with your colleagues, with your friends, what are you saying about this issue? What are you saying about this problem? What frustrates you?
I think the thing that frustrates me the most is when we're on trauma call inside of the hospital and we hear, you know, a underage victim is coming in to as basically a victim of a firearm-related injury. You could almost predict what the profile, who's going to show up. The storyline stays the same. And when you're there operating, you know, repairing, you know, whether it's a vascular injury or some injury to a solid organ, or just triaging them and consulting another service or discharging them, you know that this is something that's going to happen again, and you're waiting in anticipation.
Wow. What's the storyline? I think that's a really interesting way of putting it. You have a sense of what the storyline is going to be before you even engage.
The storyline typically is I was walking down the street, I had just gone to the store, I was sitting in the car, and somebody came by and shot me. And usually they don't know the assailant. When you get the secondary story from the investigators, then they're usually linked. Most of these aren't random. Most of them are very targeted. The perpetrators live within a certain radius of the individual that is injured. And you can almost predict the after story.
Okay, let's bring in George Lee. Let's make him a part of this conversation. George is the project manager for the End Gun Violence Step Forward Initiative. That's based in Savannah, and that's where George is with us this morning. George, good to have you on the program.
Good morning, everyone. How are you doing?
It's terrific to have you on the show. How do you describe the work of your program? What's the mission?
The mission is simple, clear, and laser-focused, that we know that 0.5% of violent offenders commit at least 80% of the violent crimes within the city, you know, and our county area. So it's simply clear and distinct. Place your guns down. If you desire to leave out of the lifestyle of group/gang violence, we have an opportunity and a way for you to escape. If not, then there's another side of suppression, you know, and prosecution. However, our side desires to bring prevention and intervention.
I want you to have a listen to a young man, Samaje Clark. He's a California teen who was shot and paralyzed in Savannah in 2015.
After I got shot, sitting in the hospital and watching how many people came in after me for either a robbery attempt or gun violence, it was just... I couldn't believe it.
George, how do you reach these young people? You offer them a couple of options. How do you reach them? What programs do you offer them?
I think it's very important. The DA's office here for Chatham County just received a wonderful grant of $660,000 that is called the Minority Youth Violence Prevention Grant. That is a joint effort by the Department of Health along with the Department of Justice. And they have decided and understand that this, as Dr. Dennis stated, is a public health issue. So through this Youth Intercept program, that we are targeting youth who have been exposed to crime violence within the inner city and within the neighborhoods, and giving them an opportunity to have consistent mentorship, consistent relationship, consistent self-esteem building. And by providing that sense of intervention and prevention, it is one step in the right direction.
And so Samaje Clark is now an activist, I believe, in the Savannah area.
Yes, yeah. I know Samaje very well. He has an awesome and powerful testimony that this situation that garnered, you know, a couple of years ago has made him not a bitter young man, but a young man that has provided opportunities for other young people to see the seriousness of gun violence and provided ways out. Mm-hmm. And Samaje is very active within our community, and he's received and garnered much support. But we need more individuals building those relationships and building those bridges.
That was my next question. Yeah.
Yes, yes. We've got to have that. That this is a several-pronged approach, that there's not one particular panacea for this, that we have to use our energies, our emotions, and our passions to be consistent. And be consistent not when something tragic takes place,
but
be consistent. Go ahead.
And George, there are others, right, in that community who are working on this issue. I want to play some sound from Kim Dulick, who you probably know as well. She started a group.
Correct.
It's called the Savannah Peace Initiative. It works to put what she calls peace poles in the areas where people have been murdered.
Once we moved here, first thought fireworks were going off, and I thought, did they really celebrate that much in Savannah? Every night we're having fireworks. And one of the neighbors said, you know, those are gunshots. It is almost an every night occurrence, and I've even got some people that have reached out to me who suffer from PTSD because of the constant gunfire.
And Omar, you want to back in on this?
Yes. You know, one of the big things is that as a level one trauma center such as Grady, we have to be able to partner with the people in the community. There are a lot of organizations doing a lot of great things, but the thing that's lacking is a uniform organization against such an issue that's really becoming a scourge of the earth. So being able to partner in organized fashion, bringing in the psychologists, the community activists, bringing in the government, mm-hmm. the church, bringing in all the different aspects and people that's needed, because it is a community problem, and we are responsible.
So let's talk about the law enforcement aspect of this. I want to play a bit of sound from George, your police chief down there, Joseph Lumpkin, and he says that gun violence and gang violence together, that both aspects of this problem, that, mm-hmm. that they just absolutely have to stop. So let's listen to the chief.
We have to hit them all over town. We also have to stop them where they are. If we don't stop them in their block, they will be in your block. So we have to have the resources to actually stop them.
George, take a moment here. We're running out of time. Describe the gang problem and the gun violence problem in general in Savannah for me.
In general, we are seeing an increasing amount of younger individuals that are involved in gang activity, group activity. We need to be taught. Our neighborhood associations need to be aware of what's going on within their neighborhoods. From an awareness, there also needs to be steps, plans of action as they are incorporated and in discussion. We must have also positive testimonies of individuals who have been brought out of this gang violence. We also must be able to share with their families in a holistic approach.
Yeah.
You're not just helping the individual. You have to help the mother, the father, the sisters, the brothers, the grandparents, because it is a
holistic.
Generational issue.
George Lee. George, appreciate it. Thank you for your time. And Dr. Danner, what a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you both. If you like Southern rock and roll, give a listen to this band from Birmingham, Alabama. It's called Lee Baines III and the Glory Fires. They're in Macon tonight as part of their Old Georgia tour. GPB intern Sophie Peel caught up with the namesake lead singer.
I'm Lee Baines. I play in a band and write songs for a band called Lee Baines and the Glory Fires. The Red Red Dirt of Home is one of those songs that is rooted in Alabama. Birmingham is just the place that I guess is the most, that feels the most true to me, but it's also charged with familial memory and public memory as well. Our part of the South is such a rich place culturally in that no matter our ethnic backgrounds or our gender or sexuality or whatever it is, a lot of us here are bound to place in a very similar way. Our cultures bleed into one another in all these really rich, complicated ways. When joy and melancholy kind of rub up against one another, and that's certainly something that I experience in a lot of church music. I've never been much into music that I would describe as like escapist. I've always kind of been drawn to music that tries to engage reality, you know what I mean? And address themes or topics that maybe public discourse tends to shy away from. The thing that's weird about being a songwriter is that I don't just shelve whatever it is once I'm done with it.
Ashes scattered across the parkway. Ozone burning up in the west. And I passed her mama's house where the years were laid out. Long lines before me where they're now all laid.
Being in a band, like I'm playing these songs night after night after night. You know, some song that I wrote years ago, I'm sort of living in constantly, you know? It almost feels at times like letter to my future self from my past self.
Everything made sense. Ain't been that way since. Carry me back.
Connor, in an essay, spoke to me so deeply in that she said, for a writer, an artist, to address any of these kind of eternal topics, the best that the writer can do is to focus on their, in her words, peculiar crossroads of time and space. She was very careful to hew closely to her own neck of the woods. I think that that's something that I'm really drawn to.
Carry me back. Carry me back.
That's Lee Baines, lead singer of Lee Baines III and the Glory Fires. The last song we heard is Roebuck Parkway off the group's first album. They perform tonight at Fresh Produce Records in Macon, Georgia as part of their All Georgia tour. More details are available for you at gpbnews.org. And that's our show for today. But as always, we want to hear from you. Who is your Southern band? Give us a call at 404-500-9457. Or you can post on Twitter or Facebook. We're at OST Talk. For today, that's on Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Tony Harris. Have a great day.